Hello, and welcome to episode 151 of Public Interest Podcast with your host, Jordan Cooper, where we interview politicians, activists, advocates, and others who seek to improve the state of the world. We are here today with Peter Franchot, the Comptroller of the State of Maryland. Peter is also a member of the Board of Public Works. He's a former Democratic delegate representing District 20 in Montgomery County, Maryland, a former Capitol Hill staffer and attorney. Peter Franchot is also a veteran of the United States Army. He's a former delegate to the Democratic National Convention in 2008, 2012, and again in 2016. Peter is also a former Democratic candidate for the United States Congress. Peter, how are you doing today?
Fabulous, Jordan, and thank you for this exercise in civic responsibility and all the podcasts you do. I appreciate it, and I know everybody who's already been interviewed by you likes the process.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. So the first question I'd like to ask you is, what are you currently doing, or what have you ever done to advance the public interest, and why?
Well, I have been a warrior for public interest issues all my life, and I'm not sure where that comes from, frankly. I think my mother taught me always to stand up to bullies, and in school I was always a gifted athlete, but not a particularly, social leader type. But I always felt much better when I was sticking up for some of the kids that were not good athletes and sometimes got picked on in the lunchroom and stuff. And so that is the genesis of my altruism, which I've carried forward in my public career. And when I got out of college after the Army, I worked for an environmental organization in Vermont that was supported by its members called Vermont Tomorrow. I then worked for the Vermont Public Interest Research Group, a Ralph Nader organization, once again up in Vermont. Then I went to law school at Northeastern, and I came down to Washington and worked for a public interest group, the Union of Concerned Scientists. Then I had the good fortune to be hired by a former congressman, now U.S. Senator, Ed Markey from Massachusetts, and was his staff director for 6 years, from 1980 to 1986. Mm-hmm. And that really I considered to be a public interest job because congressman, now Senator Markey, was an extraordinarily progressive individual elected official. Then the time I spent in the legislature, 20 years representing the People's Republic of Tacoma Park, you can't be too liberal for District 20. And I was able to continue my advocacy for the public interest. And now that I'm comptroller and have been for the last 10 years, I actually have more opportunity, more flexibility, because I have a much bigger staff, bigger responsibilities. I'm elected statewide, and I find that every day I am working in the public interest, primarily by helping individuals who are in financial situations that are difficult and complicated, but also in being available as a state elected official for anybody mm-hmm. to buttonhole me and ask me to help out with something maybe little or maybe a big issue. But so in an odd way, I don't mean to be puffing my ego up here or something, but in an odd way, I'm 69 years old now. For my entire professional life, I have been either partially or fully engaged in working for the public interest.
Interesting. And so the formation of your political identity is also an interesting topic. Obviously, going to the United States Army after college, one associates the Army with more conservative individuals. I wonder if we can start there, and if you can tell our listening audience why during the Vietnam War you ended up joining the United States Army, if there's any correlation, and then how you ended up going to law school after that.
Well, I actually didn't finish college. I was at Amherst College, and halfway through my sophomore year in January, I dropped out of Amherst College to go to New Hampshire to work on behalf of Gene McCarthy, who was running in the 1968 Democratic primary up there and was running to stop the Vietnam War. And I thought that was just a great piece of history that I could work in, the Clean with Gene presidential campaign. And I was entirely happy there. I was an organizer on campuses in a number of different states after New Hampshire, where he had a very good showing. I was there, and I was out in Indiana. I was in Pennsylvania. I was in Illinois. I was all over the place organizing college campuses for Gene McCarthy. Then I got a draft notice saying, dear sir, you no longer are protected by your college enrollment, and you are to report for the draft. Well, that was a shock to me, but...
That was somewhat ironic.
It was very ironic, but
you left college.
There I was.
You left college to join political campaigns because of the anti-Vietnam War platform of those campaigns. And by virtue of your civic activism, you actually ended up getting embroiled in the war.
Exactly. And my parents actually said I was pretty dumb and clueless, that I didn't realize I was giving up my student deferment. But such as it is, it actually, in retrospect, proved to be a tremendous experience. I was drafted for 2 years. I spent 21 months, not 24 months, because I was allowed to get out early to return to college.
Mm-hmm.
But the Army was a great experience for me, not in the sense that I enjoyed it, but I was put on a troop train in New York City and sent down to Fort Jackson, South Carolina with the other draftees. And, you know, it was a different group of people than I'd associated with in my life. And basic training was, once again, tough love. And I didn't like it, but in retrospect, I think it made me serious, a more serious person. And then I got sent to Fort Hood for advanced infantry training and to be a forward artillery observer. And I never made it to Vietnam. I basically stayed at Fort Hood. I kid people and say, you know, Texas was so bad, I actually volunteered to go to Vietnam. But that's a joke. That's a joke, Jordan. It was a pretty miserable existence, as I remember. But once again, the Army gave me some structure, some motivation to return and get my act together, get through college, and become a productive citizen. And for that, I always hold the Army in high esteem, even though I was, well, let's be generous, I was a so-so soldier. But I did my duty and did my civic duty, I guess, of being in the Army. And I've always, in retrospect, seen it as a positive experience.
So two things quickly, Peter, on the Army. One is that I've never seen you to be one to use your experience and your status as a veteran to your advantage in a political campaign. Obviously, when Anthony Brown, the lieutenant governor of Maryland, ran for governor, he used his political his military experience as a helicopter pilot in Iraq, Afghanistan to his political advantage as part of his narrative. I've never seen you use that. Why? And also, you know, you were able to survive 2 years in the Army, but you pride yourself as being a very independent-minded fiscal watchdog as comptroller. I'm wondering to what extent you were an independent-minded soldier, and if that got you in trouble when you were in the Army.
Well, it might have a little bit. I remember the drill sergeant called me college boy because I had a year of college. Nobody else did in the group of draftees that I went down to Fort Jackson. And so he ridiculed that a little bit, but that was all good for me because I had a kind of inflated view of who I was at age 20 back then. You know, I thought I was pretty hot stuff, and it was good to get the rough edges knocked off in a way that frankly proved to be a positive for me. And you know, I haven't used my veteran status. I'm not bashful about it, and I certainly don't hide it, but I didn't have the kind of career that Anthony Brown had, which is long term, and some of the other veterans that are in elected office have had you know, careers that are perhaps worthy of comment more. My experience in the Army it didn't form the basis for me to blow my own horn. I was a very ordinary cog in a very, very big machine. But I will say that the machine of the military proved to be enormously beneficial to me as an individual. And I actually recommend it to kids that I meet that are struggling to find some traction. I think it's even given all of the dangers of world combat and stuff, I think the military is a place that can be a terrific stabilizing a couple of years for young people who are confused.
So running off that idea, Peter, I'd like to ask your opinion on a matter that you don't have jurisdiction over as a comptroller, but you might have theoretically had jurisdiction over this as a state delegate for the 20 years you represented the People's Republic of Tacoma Park, Maryland. The topic is that many nations in Western Europe and perhaps in other parts of the world have service requirements for their youth. And some of these nations, obviously, military conscription is something that's widespread around the world, and that's obviously what led to you being in the military and leading to the beneficial experience that you had in the U.S. Army. My question is, do you think that there ought to be, or what are your thoughts about having guaranteed, maybe not, or well, one, mandatory requirements for all youth between certain ages to either join the military or perform public service for civil society in some other way? One would be that being mandatory, and second, that being guaranteed to everyone. Obviously, there are programs like Peace Corps, AmeriCorps, there are lots of volunteer programs, but there certainly are Teach for America, but there certainly are not a sufficient number of slots to accommodate every Marylander youth who would like to do public service.
No, I generally support that concept. Once again, the experience I had in the Army may not be the same experience other people would have, but I think it's very important for kids who are, you know, between 18 and 25 to be required. I would consider it to be mandatory. I think it should be mandatory that every young person puts at least a year of their lives towards some constructive public purpose, either serving in the military, teaching in a school, or, you know, involved in infrastructure. And I am a big supporter of that. I would like to see former veterans included in some leadership capacity. I don't suggest that everybody has to go through boot camp, but I do think it's an opportunity to install some structure and discipline and gives a sense of purpose to some young people's lives. And it's particularly important now, Jordan, because, as you know, the economy is changing in front of our eyes. Robots and machines are automating what were tasks that generally humans were hired to do in manufacturing jobs. Well, now we've got this globalization and modernization using technology, and a lot of jobs are being eliminated. It's causing a tremendous amount of dislocation in the country and around the world. I think that a mandatory 1 or 2 year program for young people where they are involved in some kind of public interest activity, but they are getting the chance to learn about the new economy rather than the old one. I mean, just think about this for a minute. Someday soon, we're not going to have any taxi cab drivers.
Because of driverless cars. And the one thing that kids lack when they leave college or leave high school is professional experience. And the one thing that's stopping them from getting picked up by employers right away is they lack professional experience. So having a mandatory service project will give them the opportunity to duly give back to the state and the nation that has given them so much in a free public education, but also an opportunity to gain real on-the-job experience that will make them more marketable in the new economy.
Yeah, so I'm not exactly sure of how you would finance this national effort. It could be from a tax on robots, but if you don't like taxes, It could be on some kind of Maryland or United States national or state equivalent of war bonds, where you ask people to participate. But the key is that every person between 18 and 25, let's pick that, gets 2 years of skill building. And you're right, learning how to show up on time for a job and what it takes to hold a job in the private sector. But I'm more interested in the imperative about that, not so much for the reason I benefited, which was, you know, getting the rough edges knocked off me. I think it's more imperative now because this whole job situation is changing. I mentioned driverless cars. So how many mm-hmm. taxi cab drivers? What about robots delivering you food at a restaurant?
Mm-hmm.
And or some equivalent of that. I know it's a little bit far-fetched, but we're in the process of machines replacing people in the workforce. So we have to come up with new jobs and new ways of employing people, especially our young people. And so I think you're onto something there with the mandatory service, how to pay for it and how it's structured, and what exactly the jobs of the future are going to be. Is you know, still out of the jury, still out.
So, on transitioning a little bit on the topic, back to the topic of you being comptroller, right? We're just talking about finding jobs, giving job experience, and how to pay for it. Two things. One, I'd like to ask you to define what a comptroller is, since some of our listeners may not know what that is. And let's start with that, and then I have some follow-up questions.
The comptroller of the state of Maryland is a statewide elected position. It was established in 1851 to oversee the finances of the state. The state was in bankruptcy because back then the treasurer made all sorts of unwise investments. And so they created in the state constitution the position of comptroller, and I'm the chief fiscal officer of the state. According to the constitution, I'm the fiscal steward of the state. So I collect all the taxes, process 3.2 million tax returns a year. I'm heavily involved in issuing of tax refunds very speedily. We're fighting tax fraud, which is an emerging problem. That's the core responsibility of the office. In addition, I'm on the three-member Board of Public Works, which is not a very well-known panel, but it's extremely powerful in Maryland. It's unique in the country because I'm on it, the governor's on it, and the state treasurer. The governor and I are independently elected. Right now, we happen to come from different parties. He's a Republican, I'm a Democrat. The mm-hmm. treasurer is elected by the legislature. Well, this panel approves $9 to $10 billion in state contracts every year. We meet every 2 weeks, and it's an enormous kind of clearinghouse of taxpayer funding for different contracts, et cetera. So, and then the job's got all sorts of other aspects to it. I'm on the Board of Trustees of the state pension system on all sorts of various boards. So it's generally a fiscal position, but because it's elected and mm-hmm. because it's statewide, mm-hmm. it's somewhat unique. Other states do not have elected comptrollers. Some do, but most have appointed budget officers.
So you mentioned the Board of Public Works, and you alluded to the fact that you sit on the Board of Public Works with the governor and the treasurer, the treasurer, of course, being Nancy Copp, a Democrat, and you being a Democrat, and then the governor being a Republican, Larry Hogan. Now, you also made a previous allusion to your representation of a very liberal, progressive, somewhat socialist-leading constituency in Tacoma Park, Silver Spring area, Montgomery County, when you were a delegate. The reason I bring this up is that you mentioned that when you were a delegate in the House of Delegates, you couldn't be too liberal. You were very far to the left. Of course, since Larry Hogan was elected 2 years ago in 2014, he and you have come, at least in the public image, to have quite a personal friendship and have come to work together, it seems, quite well. And that's reflected in what seems to some individuals in Maryland as you having evolved to have a more moderate and less liberal stance than you previously had in your 2 decades in the House of Delegates. Could you elaborate for a moment on your gradual evolution, the gradual evolution of your political identity, and how that, I guess, occurred within the confines of real politics, needing to work on this board with an executive of another party?
Well, it actually started when I was first elected, because the office, by definition, because it has a fiscal focus, oversight focus, demands that you have some independence from whatever political machine you might ordinarily have allegiance to down in Annapolis. That people, when they vote for the state comptroller in Maryland, expect, since it's a statewide office, they expect someone who is fiscally moderate, but most of all independent of the normal political machinations. They expect that. Now, if you become someone who is harmful and opposed to your own party's values, I suppose you can be subject to defeat in a primary election. But I follow two truths. One truth that I hold very strongly is that working in the public interest as an elected official is a noble profession. And the second truth I follow is that there's nothing wrong with bipartisanship. And so I have actively, during my 10 years as comptroller, tried to drop the partisanship, except when it gets around election time. And I've tried to sincerely, not rhetorically or in a fake way, pretend that I'm bipartisan. I have tried to be independent, I guess, is the word that I would use to describe myself. And since the election of Governor Hogan 2 years ago, yes, we've formed a friendship, but it's mostly around moderate fiscal policies where we have a strategic partnership on the Board of Public Works. I think it's single-handedly that relationship has resulted in the fiscal house of the state of Maryland being put in much better shape. I don't want to take too much credit for doing things on the Board of Public Works, but on things such as procurement, state procurement, we have significantly reduced single bid procurement awards, which contract awards. Why is that important? Generally, if you only have a single bidder for a state contract, and it's generally the incumbent vendor who is the single bidder, how do the taxpayers know that they're getting a good deal? Because there's no transparency, there's no competition, there's no accountability. So together, Governor Hogan and I have significantly cut down on the number of single bid contracts. That's good for the state of Maryland.
Now,
unfortunately, it gets characterized as being, sleeping with the enemy or something like that is how it's described. Sure. It's not that. It's just reaching out, getting results, focusing on things other than party politics and who's going to be the next governor, and focusing on needs of the people. And I think it's well received by the public. But who knows? I've been elected 3 times. Each time I've gotten more votes than anyone else in that election. And I'm now going to be on the ballot in 2018. So I'll test my luck with the public again.
So I guess I'd like to ask, so you work right now as comptroller to, you know, try to identify tax cheats and bring them to task and reduce cigarette smuggling and illegal alcohol and fuel sales. You'd like to you say that you're closing corporate tax loopholes and really arguing for fiscal responsibility as an independent fiscal watchdog. I'm not sure would you describe that as being the primary platforms that you ran as delegate and the primary legislative achievements you had in the House of Delegates? And if not, you know, how did it come to pass that you decided that running for comptroller against incumbent, I think William Donald Schaefer, was the right thing to do, especially since these issues aren't the sexiest, and it may not have been those that were most near and dear to your heart in the beginning of your political career?
Well, let me be brutally honest. William Dillon Schaefer, the former mayor, iconic mayor of Baltimore, iconic political figure, governor, and also comptroller for two terms, he didn't like me very much for running against him. And ironically, I ran against him on the theme that I'm a real Democrat and that he wasn't, and because he'd gotten so close to George H.W. Bush and other national Republicans. But given that, the reason that I have moved to the center on fiscal issues is because of the nature of the job that I have. We have 1,100 people working for the comptroller's office. I have expert folks briefing me on economic issues, and that has caused me to come more in the center on fiscal issues. And that's been very well received by the voters, not just around the state, but frankly also in District 20, my old liberal district, because there's a myth out there that liberal Democrats or progressive Democrats are somehow not concerned about fiscal matters. They are. Mm-hmm. And they're concerned about them in their own budgets. They're concerned about them in their own small businesses. They're concerned about them in the state politics, but those are not often talked about by the state Democratic Party. We're often just talking about, you know, issues that are very important, like discrimination and gun control and issues that I've worked on, but they're more cultural issues than they are economic issues. And so that's the reason I've moved to the center on fiscal issues, but I remain a absolutely rock-solid Democrat and have been my entire life.
I'd like to, we are approaching the end of the podcast, and I'd like to ask you a final question, Peter, which is to speak to the taxpayers of the state of Maryland. And I'd like you to take a moment and explain why being a politician is a noble profession, why being independent is possible, that you actually can act in what you believe is the best interest of the public at large. And take a moment and speak to the taxpayers of Maryland and say why it is that you've been motivated to serve the public interest. You spoke about it in the beginning, but why is it noble? Why have you been motivated? And at the end of the day, you're 69 years old. You spent you've spent quite a deal of time making the world better for Americans. I'd like to ask you to share your thoughts on why really you have what your legacy is of all those years of service.
Well, I enjoy the opportunity to make a difference, and I'm very honored and very privileged to be the comptroller for the last 10 years. It's a large statewide office. There are very few of them in Maryland, and it gives me an opportunity to do the right thing for people, and I'm grateful to the voters for letting me do that. But recently, we helped an elderly woman in Western Maryland who we found had fallen way behind on her taxes, and she owed quite a sum of money in back taxes. And I put her on a payment plan. I believe it was $5 every month. No, $5 every 2 weeks. And the staff came to me and said, sir, with all due respect, the woman is going to have to live to be 142 to pay the state back for the back taxes. And I said, that's fine. I understand that. But we're not here to make her life miserable. She doesn't feel right about falling behind on her taxes, but we're not going to get a pound of flesh from her. We're going to simply, because she didn't have very much money, we're simply going to put her on the payment plan that she can afford. It's that mm-hmm. ability to inject myself into situations where the bureaucracy might be more harsh and where I can supply some empathy that I value so highly. And is politics a noble profession? Absolutely. And it's harder than you think. But here I've kind of broken through and I have this great position. Now, what's happened recently in politics is a little troubling to me because the hyper partisans on either side have kind of assume control of their individual parties. And look, nobody believes as strongly as I do that Donald Trump should not be president of the United States. I think he's a reckless individual. I think he's a vulgar individual. I think he's an individual who's completely impulsive and volatile and, frankly, a danger because of his personality. However, his followers should not be punished or confronted and shouted at by our side. We need to get his supporters and the Clinton supporters together and have them talk more to each other so that they don't, we don't end up neighbors hating neighbors because of who they support politically. And I think I'm positive. I can play a positive force in urging people, despite the emotions of the day, to try to be rational and level-headed and empathetic. And don't just because you don't like Donald Trump, and I've already indicated my opinion of him, don't say that everybody that, for example, has an R after their name for being Republican should therefore be treated with disdain and hatred also. You don't need that. You can oppose Donald Trump or support Donald Trump and still interact with your neighbors and friends and the parents of the kids that your kids go to school with. And I hope we can avoid what we're seeing right now, which is a lot of very unfortunate negative emotions being expressed by both sides. And that's something that I hope to play a calming role in as the in the next 5 to 7 years as we try to recover from this recent election.
That has been Peter Francho, the Comptroller of the State of Maryland, a member of the Board of Public Works, former Democratic delegate from District 20, a former Hill staffer, an attorney, a veteran of the United States Army, a fiscal watchdog, self-described, a former delegate to the National Convention, and a former Democratic nominee for Congress, who speaks about the noble profession of public service through elected office or otherwise, who has been on the front lines as a campaigner, as an advocate for environmental issues alongside Ralph Nader, who speaks about the importance of having empathy for those with whom one differs. He calls for greater civility and respect in the national dialogue as we talk about the many challenges facing our great nation. Peter is a man who's willing to be pragmatic when it comes to advancing the public interest, and he's willing to put aside any sort of reservations he may have with another's approach to the public interest and find compromise. Because for Peter, as we've heard before with other interviewees, a half loaf is better than no loaf at all. And making sure that everyone gets a fair shake and that we humanize the political process, whether it be by enabling a woman of limited means to feel like she is responsible and she's being fair and she's being treated fairly by the state, but she's also trying the best she can to pull her weight, and or whether he's humanizing followers of an individual with for whom he does not have much respect. Peter is someone who seeks to raise the path of public service to something of a noble calling, and that is why he touts the benefits of bipartisanship and essentially empathy in his lifelong path of public service. Peter, thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Thank you.
And this has been episode 151 of Public Interest Podcast with your host, Jordan Cooper, where we interview politicians, activists, advocates, and others who seek to improve the state of the world. I'll remind you to subscribe, as 16,000 listeners have listened. Listen to publicinterestpodcast.com. You can listen on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, Blueberry, Player FM, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn. And should you wish to communicate with Peter, you can call 240-630-0380 and leave a voicemail that will be emailed to him. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.